Okay, good to see everybody. This is our fourth class in 1 Corinthians 7, though as you can see it's our 15th. It didn't turn out as well as I hoped. Ted, how do we get rid of that screen down below there?
Reboot.
It's not going to hurt us particularly, I hope, because I don't think I've squeezed a lot at the bottom of all the slides. But what that's supposed to say is the Isthmus of Corinth in 1866, and that this would be our 15th class, actually, on marriage and divorce and remarriage as a subset of our studies in 1 Corinthians 7. As you've noticed, I love these old paintings from the great explorers of the past. And, of course, long before the canal's been put in and all that. But this is the 3.5-mile isthmus right through here where shipping was brought to save hundreds of miles in sailing around the peninsula. But they're able to draw the boats overland. So back in 1866, this is what one individual saw from an overlook of the region of Corinth. This, however, is not Corinth itself, which would actually be behind from where the artist was standing right here. But it does show the shipping lanes. Since we have been in 1 Corinthians 7 then, Paul writing to the people in this region, I thought wise to just have a very quick outline of what we've already covered. And so we looked at the first 9 verses, and in those verses saw Paul addressing those who were unmarried. They were not married. He was saying then in the course of those 9 verses that it is better to marry than to burn because of fornications. Let each man have his own wife. Let each wife have her own husband. He says a number of things, of course, in those 9 verses, but he summarizes it all under the statement, better to marry than to burn. Then in verse 10, though actually you can't rightly, I guess, separate 11 from it, but in verse 10, to the marrieds, he says, remain married. So stay that way. But in verse 11, he recognizes that sometimes that doesn't happen. So for those that are now unmarried, I'll read verse 11, if she does leave, let her remain unmarried. So a divorce has taken place. She's now unmarried. And this would work for the men, of course, as well. We talked about that a couple of times. Should not send his wife away. She shouldn't send him away. And so they should remain unmarried or be reconciled. But that, of course, is subject to what he's already spent 9 verses telling us. So they should remain unmarried or be reconciled if they can. It's still better to marry than to burn. God hasn't suspended the first 9 verses when he gets to the 10th or the 11th. Then in verses 12 through 24, so I took a really big bite right there, but in 12 through 24, Paul is talking to the rest. Now, there's a number of things that are discussed in there, of course, but it's addressed to the rest who are defined as those in which only one party in the marriage is a saint. Only one party is a Christian. And then, again, you are to remain married if possible, but the unbeliever might leave. And so we come back to the same idea. Verses 1 through 9, it's still better to marry than to burn. If you have an unbelieving mate, they're not content to dwell with you, then they leave. You're perfectly free to marry again, but it'd be better if you didn't. So throughout, he's going to be, especially in these next verses, indicating that it's better that you not ever marry for a couple of different reasons. For 2 prominent reasons, very different reasons. So better not to marry at all, but then it's better to marry than to burn. That's to burn sexually. And if you get married, you ought to stay that way. But circumstances happen, and so he starts giving advice in individual cases, which will bring us into 25 and 26. And we did talk about these verses last week, but I'm going to start there actually this morning. So now he's going to address the virgins in particular. Now, of course, a virgin has never been married. That virgin is therefore unmarried. They never have married. That puts them in the category, word used 4 times in the passage here or in the chapter here, of the unmarried. But the divorced are also unmarried. The widows and widowers are also unmarried. So I can think of three different ways you could be in the category unmarried, and Paul mentions each and every one of them and uses the term unmarried for all of them. So in 25 and 26, let's read what he says first to the virgins in particular. Now concerning virgins, I have no command of the Lord, but I give an opinion as one who by the mercy of the Lord is trustworthy. I think then that this is good in view of the present distress, that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Now, I've pointed out that we had a total of 9 verses on it's being better to marry than to burn, but 18 verses that are on remaining in the condition in which you're called. So if you're new today, visiting with us for the first time, we've been over this material, you know, in preceding classes. But the two things that Paul spends the most time on in the chapter are it's better to marry than to burn, and you should remain in the condition in which you are called, that is, called to Christ. Now, with the virgins, he's saying the same thing. 25 and 26, concerning virgins, I have no command of the Lord, but I give an opinion as one who by the mercy of the Lord is trustworthy. I think then this is good in view of the present distress, that it's good for a man to remain as he is. So just stay that way. Remain unmarried. If you can, we're going to find, particularly this is repeated a couple of times in the upcoming verses, verses 1 through 9 are still underlying everything that's being said. It'll still be better to marry than to burn, but for you virgins, you should remain unmarried if you can. Now, there's two questions, of course, that always come up. I have no command of the Lord, but I give an opinion as one who by the mercy of the Lord is trustworthy. Does that mean that either just this verse, its attendant verse 26, or the whole chapter, or the whole book, refer to stuff that Paul is making up on his own? When he says, I have no command of the Lord, is he saying, I just want you to understand this is not inspired, the Holy Spirit is not guiding me, I'm going to give an opinion like any one of you might have an opinion, but I think my opinion's better than your opinion because I'm deemed trustworthy. Now, everybody freely grants, I suppose it could mean that, but that would sure be weird. You know, in an epistle that begins and continues and ends the way that it does, I don't think Paul is trying to say, this is a take-it-or-leave-it proposition. You may reject what I'm saying here because it's just my opinion. I don't think that. What I think he's trying to say is one of two things, both of which make this, you know, divine legislation. One of them would go back to not I but the Lord, and then the Lord not I, which again we've already talked about, which would be a reference to what Jesus did and did not address while he was on the earth and therefore in the four Gospels. So we can find some information about marriage, divorce, and remarriage in the Gospels that's in the mouth of Jesus, which Paul has specifically said does not address especially this circumstance that we just saw in verses 12 through 24. When Jesus was speaking on the earth in the flesh, there were no Christians. There were no Christians married to an unbeliever. Jesus never talks about that. Anytime we go back to Jesus in the Gospels and say, this is what he says you should do if you're married to an unbeliever, Paul specifically says, you're wrong, you're making a mistake. Jesus never talked about them. So it could mean that. It's a different way of Paul saying, you're not going to find this information in the Gospels, but I'm telling you. I don't think that's it either. What I really think is happening here is he is saying what he also has said earlier. I'm not ordering this to be done. I'm not forcing you in this particular admonition that I'm giving. It is inspired. It's God moving through me. When he says in verse 25, my opinion as one who by the mercy of the Lord is trustworthy. By the mercy of the Lord, he has been trustworthy enough to become what? An inspired apostle full of the Holy Spirit who's writing Bible books. Now, I don't think that's changed at all. So, in my opinion, I think what all Paul is meaning to say right there is, you know, I give my opinion, but it's an inspired opinion. And as earlier, I am not saying one thing and one thing only, which will wind up contradicting other things that I've said in this passage or chapter. So, concerning virgins, I have no command of the Lord, but I give an opinion as one who by the mercy of the Lord is trustworthy. I think then this is good in view of the present distress, that it's good for a man to remain as he is. Now, he's going to immediately say in 27 and 28, are you bound to a wife? Don't seek to be released. Are you released from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you should marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin should marry, she has not sinned. Yet such will have trouble in this life, and I'm trying to spare you. So his opinion is inspired by God to tell them, you're going to be happier, and he's about to develop this at very great length, if you stay unmarried. But I'm not ordering it. It's not a command. So it's my opinion in that sense. Now, you can wrestle with that. Everybody has. You may wind up eventually on three different sides of the issue, you know, and cycling through them as most people do in their Bible study. I'll leave you to work the problem. But I take everything in these 40 verses of this chapter to be inspired information, and none of it is just Paul's idea that you can accept or reject. It came from God. You'd be wise and pay attention to it. So, 25 and 26. Now, let's look at 27 and 28. We just read them. Wait a second. I think I forgot something. Oh, yeah, the present distress. Okay, I'm sorry. Let's go back to that present distress. What is it? That's right, you don't know. Okay, it's not possible to know. He doesn't tell us what the present distress is, so you can't know. Does the present distress endure to this day? Well, maybe. You can't know. It was present then. Does that mean it's going to go away? Well, it doesn't say that at all. It just says it's occurring right now. Will it go away? Only the boldest assertion and assumption would say that it did. You don't know. So we don't know what it was. We can't tell you how long it lasted. Whether it lasted for 2 weeks or two millenniums or, you know, whatever. We don't know. Yes?
You're very good at attaching the historical context to many places.
Mm-hmm.
Can't you do that here? Are they under Roman persecution?
Yeah, see, I really can't. I can speculate, and I've got an idea, and I'm trying to stay away from, you know, really being, you know, putting too much of an oar in the water, I guess. Because I don't even know so much of the present distress is limited to Corinth. It could be uniquely Corinth's problem. Or it could be because they are living in the days of what Jesus called the Great Tribulation, which would lead up eventually to the fall of Jerusalem. And by the way, if you read your history, and I highly recommend it, outside the Bible in these years, Rome was in terrible trouble. There was all kinds of problems going on. So was it just that it was an economic problem with the instability of the Roman Empire, which is currently being led by an exceptionally young Nero? Is it just in Corinth, or is it Roman-wide? Is it just for a few days, weeks, months, or years, or is it going to last? We don't know, because Paul doesn't say. So, whatever it is, he says it's best if you don't marry during this present distress. But he's also going to say it's best if you don't marry ever, for the reasons he's going to now give. So there are now two reasons why it is that it would be better to remain unmarried. So if you've never married, stay that way. If you have married, stay that way. If you can stay married, but, you know, you would stay married rather, but the unbeliever leaves, well, you know, now you can't. But it'd be better now that you remain unmarried again, now that you've been divorced by that unbeliever. But, well, you know, it's better to marry than to burn. And so I'm not giving a command. I'm not demanding, I'm not requiring that anybody stay unmarried. In this chapter, I don't believe Paul ever does that. He never tells anybody, you've lost your right to be married. Everything he says applies. And if you wind up in the unmarried category, then you have these options. But you'd be smarter if you don't marry. So now, 27 and 28. In 27 and 28, are you bound to a wife? Well, that means, are you married? Doesn't seem to be any other bond in the passage anywhere, nowhere in 1 Corinthians 7. We're talking about these other bonds. We're not talking about buying a house. We're not talking about those kind of things. We're talking about marriage. Are you bound to a wife? Then married to one. Do not seek to be released. Well, there'd be only two ways you could do that. You could kill her, or you could divorce her. Now, you can't kill her, and have God be happy about it, but that's one way to get released. And if you did kill her, and there weren't any witnesses, she's dead. Can you marry again? You got big problems. You're a murderer. But do you lose your right to marry because you killed your spouse? No. Don't seek to be released, divorced or otherwise, but are you released? Well, if you're a widower and you didn't kill her, but, she died of natural causes, if you've been divorced, don't seek a wife. But if you should marry, you have not sinned. You have not sinned. And if a virgin should do that. So you know we're talking about widows and divorced in the unmarrieds, three categories in this passage. All three are being mentioned, and the virgins are being singled out. If you do that, you have not sinned. Yet, such will have trouble in this life, and I'm trying to spare you. And it's at this point then, what he said is, I had to abbreviate for the sake of the line here, but married, unmarried, or virgins should remain unmarried. Unless what, brethren? Did any one of these three lose the right to the controlling verses 1 through 9 that establish the foundation of marriage so as to avoid fornication? No. So as we go along here, it becomes abundantly plain, and I'm begging everybody, continue to study on this and think about this, but time and again, a statement will be made. And if you take this away, some people say, well, in this case, it doesn't apply those first nine verses, but in that case, it does. And in no case does Paul say, well, here I'm taking it away. So I'm understanding him to universally recognize it's better to marry than to burn, but it's better never to marry at all. So however you become unmarried, stay that way. Unless it's better to marry than to burn. You're going to have problems in this life, and that's what we want to read next. 29 through 35. So here's a big chunk again. 29. This I say, brethren, the time has been shortened. Saber, you want to ask that same question again? Okay. What's the historical context here? Well, brethren, I think this has to do with the upcoming destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Where's Jerusalem in relation to Corinth? Well, it's 1,000 miles away. How will the destruction of Corinth impact everything? Whether you're a Jew, a Gentile, a Roman, or a Greek, or whatever you are, during these times we have the great tribulation that's talked about. And Jesus specifically said in Matthew 24, unless those days had been shortened, then what? No life would have been saved. So you hear it ringing in the verbiage, don't you? What Jesus had already said back in Matthew 24. But it isn't specifically developed in this passage. So again, I want to be very careful. What does this present distress? Well, the time is shortened. Does that mean the present distress is coming to an end, or the worst of it is about to come? What time was shortened? The beginning or the end of it?
Again, you're linking the fall of Jerusalem and the terror that followed with Corinthians. And they're not there.
That's correct.
They suffer repercussions But they're not in Jerusalem.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what I'm saying. We're talking about Corinth, as I mentioned earlier. Does none of this apply to anybody else except Corinth? Should we just assume that because the letter is written to Corinth, that therefore it doesn't apply to anybody else? Well, in this case, I don't think we should, any more than we should take a given thing and then deny the first nine verses. I think it's a universal passage. Now, how is the circumstances surrounding Jerusalem going to impact Corinth? Well, in a variety of ways, which again you can read about in the history, but these are such troublous times that before Jerusalem falls, Nero's going to commit suicide. And then during the siege of Jerusalem and after the siege of Jerusalem, the nation of the whole Roman Empire is going to be in such bad shape that many of the living historians at that time wrote they thought it was the end of the Roman Empire. They thought the whole thing was going to collapse. Armies were on the move. Rebellions were taking place in all, you know, different areas. Rome is conscripting soldiers to go out, you know, to do battle. It did not matter where you lived in the Roman Empire. In this time frame, everything was topsy-turvy and up for grabs. So eventually Vespasian, who had been sent by Nero to go start, you know, the assault on Jerusalem, he had to come back home when Nero committed suicide because he saw it was the end. He couldn't maintain the empire anymore. So he went and killed himself. Now talk about instability. And so finally Vespasian had to go back to take up being the emperor himself, and finally was able to establish some of this stability, which left Titus, you know, there. So, you know, I'm very conversant with the history, but I'm not so conversant with it that I can say this exactly is what Paul meant, and it started here and it ended there, and from this point on, the present distress is over, so all the advice that he gives, which is influenced by the present distress, no longer applies. I can't do that. I don't know anybody else who can't either, so feel too bad about it. We just don't know. So wish. But yeah, I think it has to do with the instability of the entire Roman Empire in those days. Nonetheless, you know, and bear in mind, it's in this general time frame. Who is the first Roman emperor to persecute Christians? It's been Jewish persecution all the way through, and the Romans wanted no part of it. Who finally is the Roman Empire emperor who says, now I'm going to persecute Christians? It's Nero. What did he blame on the Christians? The burning of Rome, which many suspect is a fire he set. For years he had been wanting to rebuild Rome. And he was being resisted by everybody who owned a home, you know. And so they, you know, there's reason to suspect at least that he himself may have set that fire. Now he gets to rebuild the city like he'd been planning to do for years, but he needs a scapegoat. So who did he pick? You know, Christians. Now, that means if he's emperor, where can he persecute Christians? Anywhere he wants. And as soon as he puts out a royal edict, these Christians are nefarious insurgents in our country who burnt our capital city down. Do you suppose there might be a merchant or two in Corinth who thinks that since his business just got sunk, since most of it is with Rome, that he'd be unhappy with the local Christians who Nero says are responsible for it? So I'm reading between the lines, Saber. You know, I recognize that. But these are really valid candidates. Let's put it that way. Okay, now, 29 through 35. This I say, brethren, the time has been shortened so that from now on, those who have... Now on, by the way, does not seem to have a termination point stipulated. So again, does that mean only throughout the present distress, which we don't know what it is or how long it lasts? You know, it's hard for us. They had more insight into this than we do. But I can't answer questions, you know, I don't have answers for. So from now on, those who have wives should be as though they had none. Well, what does that mean? Every marriage vow has just been suspended? Are there no marriages at all? Did God just decree that every marriage has been invalidated? Well, of course not. But he says, we got this present distress, we got, you know, this time that's going to be shortened, but from now on, should be as though they had none. Does that mean they don't have any? Or that they should only behave as if they didn't? It's the latter. Well, why should you behave as if you didn't? Does that mean you shouldn't behave like a husband or a wife to your mate? And again, brethren, I'd say no. What I think it is, Saber, you know, as close as I can get up and dance on the line there, he's saying, when Christians get persecuted, what is the most powerful thing you can do to make somebody renounce their faith? It's to threaten to torment, torture, and kill family. Nothing is more powerful than that. If you can love, you know, Jesus more than husband or wife, mother, father, children, that's the standard. It's what Jesus calls us to. But it's the highest possible worst test you could ever face. So I think what he's saying is, really difficult times going on right now. If you're smart, you won't get married. If you do, you're going to have trouble. But if you are, then you need to recognize that when these tests come, you can't make your decision based on whether or not you're married. You're going to have to make this decision on whether or not you want to go to heaven, whether or not you're going to be faithful to your God. So let's read it through now in 29. This I say, brethren, the time has been shortened, so that from now on those who have wives should be as though they had none, and those who weep as though they did not weep, those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, those who buy as though they did not possess, those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it, for the form of this world is passing away. Now here we go again. I see this big rabbit just jumped out of the bushes, running through the room. And I understand that. It's all very valid. But I'm just, you know, determined desperately now to get through 1 Corinthians here in 5 lessons instead of the 3 I originally, you know, had planned. But what we want to do here is to see this. The form of this world is an expression that may refer to some universal, global cataclysm, which hasn't happened yet. We usually call the end of the world. Personally, I don't think that's it at all. I think what he's talking about is this current age. That's the term Jesus used so often. The form of the world we're living in right now, which is the Roman world, is passing away. It was about to go into terrible time called the Great Tribulation. The Jews and the Gentiles were going to suffer horribly and did. We have numerous contemporary historians who tell us this. And then that form of that world was going to pass away entirely when Christianity is the last man standing in God's religions. Jew and Gentile were both, the Jewish religion and Christianity were both religions that God started and was still operating. And for a Jew who had not heard the gospel yet, he's supposed to be practicing. For those then who hear it, but they aren't sure about it for some years, they continue to study, you got to still be a Jew. Temple standing, priesthood's functioning. But soon, the temple's going to burn down, September 70 AD. When it does, the whole Jewish nation will not have their religion or even their national identity anymore. Many of them are going to be persecuted and killed. Some tossed out of Rome that Paul got to meet, you know, in the book of Acts. And so, this all this distress is going on. I think it's the form of the Roman world, which, if you've been with me in the Revelation studies, is the oikoumene. Now again, we're getting way away from marriage, divorce, and remarriage. I don't have time now to get in a whole study of oikoumene. You've got cosmos, the word that would most often refer to the universe. You've got geis, which almost without exception refers to the tribal lands of Israel. yet it gets translated world and creates all kinds of mischief in understanding about the end of the age issues. Because if you don't know it's geis and it's talking about Israel and not the whole planet, the word is not cosmos, you know, that changes everything. Most people don't read it that way. They just see world or earth in the translation. They don't know they're two different Greek words, and they just, you know, get derailed. Okay, but worst of all of this is oikoumene. Oikoumene gets translated world. And it's okay, I guess. But Josephus, who is a contemporary, born in the time of Jesus' birth and dies after the fall of Jerusalem, who witnessed the fall of Jerusalem and gave us the most full account of the fall of Jerusalem, he defines the oikoumene by stipulating in his text the geographical boundaries on all four sides of the Roman Empire, not the planet, and not the tribal lands of Israel. He refers as a first century Jew to the oikoumene as the Roman Empire. I think the form of the world we're talking about here is that of the Roman Empire and not the planet. But please, I must hasten on. So, then we have 32. I want you to be free from concern. So whatever you're facing, and it's got to be a physical nature, something's going to happen in their carnal, material, physical lives. I want you to be free from concern during that period of time. While that's going on, I'm trying to not have you be overly burdened with worries, because your mates and children are threatened, you're threatened, you know, property's threatened, all this instability is going on. I want that. So in 32, and then in 34, he will now give us the last two of his four uses of the word agamos, the unmarrieds. I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried, a virgin, a divorcee, a widower. I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. And his interests are divided. And the woman who is unmarried, virgin, divorcee, or a widow, it says, and the virgin, so again he's stipulating, never been married or was and now aren't, is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. Now, brethren, that is just a fact. So it's not a sin if you get married. But if you do, your interests will be divided. It's not as easy to serve the Lord, and persecutors can put more pressure on you. You got major problems. My wife and I have major problems right now. I'll give you a little illustration. Quite a few, 30 years ago, I was in the building trades. I worked with a custom home builder. And together, we built a total of 44 homes. Every one of them ended up in a divorce. It was terrible being in construction. Well, I don't know if you see this, Dean, too. But all the decisions that go along put so much stress on a marriage, it was unbelievable. So here, it's supposed to be the happiest time of their life. They're building a custom home. And now they come into our office, and we contract with them to build that home. And let the fighting begin. Well, I want the bathroom to be on this side. I want that side. Move this wall. Different color. You know, I want two-story. I want one. And then we start building it after they agreed on the plans. And still, every day, something new comes up. The stresses were amazing. We watched every one of those marriages end up in divorce. And we were only with them for 4 months. Now, we hear about them years after. They didn't all end in that 4 months. But we watch these people just blow up because they were stressed. A lot of money. So they're upset, they're concerned, and that stress mounts, and pretty soon they're turning on each other. But I want you to be free from concern. So, brethren, never build a house. Is it a sin if you do? No, I designed and built one in our marriage lasted. I have to be the first. But Don and I, right now, I want to buy this house. She says, no, I don't like that house. You go, okay, well, look at that house. What house do you want? Well, I don't know. You look. Well, I just did, and I wanted this one. Yeah, I know, but I don't like that one. Okay. So here we go. Well, you know, it's not going to tear our marriage apart. But are we under more or less strain now than we were? A whole lot more. It was very peaceful up until about a week ago when somebody made an offer on our house. And then everything just got worse. Brother, that's all Paul is saying. And marriage is included in all of this. He's just saying, I want you to have a happier life. So, don't get married and don't build houses. You'll be happier. Now, let's come back to 32. I want you to be free from concern. One who's unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. One who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. His interests are divided. And the woman who's unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But one who's married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And this I say, and I think it bears on these expressions we were worried about before, not I but the Lord, in my opinion. This I say for your own benefit, not to put a restraint on you, but to promote what is seemly and a secure, undistracted devotion to the Lord. I'm not ordering anybody, Paul says, to get married. I'm not ordering anybody to get divorced. I'm not forbidding anybody to get married. I'm not forbidding anybody, you know, from getting a divorce. If your wife commits adultery, you can divorce her. But I just, Paul says, his overarching concern, want you to be free to worship the Lord in the times that we're living or circumstances that we're living, whether it's the whole world, you know, down to this day or just in Corinth or ends next week, doesn't matter. These principles always work the same way. Will you have less problems in the world if you're not married? Yes, you will. And that's because marriage leads to children, and there's nothing worse than that. And there's nothing better than that. But you can't have them and be free from concern. So Paul's not forbidding anything. He's not commanding anything. He is counseling what is good, better, and best. Now, that being said, and time almost up, so for everybody, he's saying, it's best to be unmarried. That's best. So, he just took the first 9 verses off the table and we can't invoke these anymore, right? No, it's still better to marry than to burn, even if it's not the best. It'll always be better to marry than to burn. And not the best. Best is don't get married. But if you must, then you can, and you have not sinned. Now, 36 through 40, and in a summary statement, we'll get this done. 36 through 40. If any man thinks he's acting unbecomingly toward his virgin, if you're looking at a Bible, it has in italics, daughter. The word doesn't exist in the original text. I believe in the New American Standard, when they do that, that it helps enormously because that's my view of these verses. I think daughters is what's involved here. But some people think betrothed. I see the argument. I'm not here to tell you that, you know, there's anything that's going to resolve it really dramatically either. I guess I did cut off. We will reboot Ted afterward. 36 through 40. What he's, you know, trying to help us to see here is that somebody has control over a young woman. Is it her betrothed or is it her parents? I vote parents. If any man thinks he's acting unbecomingly toward his virgin daughter, if she should be of full age, which, by the way, was considerably younger than we count full age today, and if it must be so, I think because of the first 9 verses in the chapter, let him do what he wishes. He does not sin. You can let your daughter marry. But if this parent stands firm in his heart, he's under no constraint but has authority over his own will. Now, that might involve his wife, that might involve the daughter. I could see, you know, some weak men here who don't have, you know, the power to overcome these constraints. He has authority. He can stand on his own two feet and make it happen. He has decided this in his own heart, to keep his own virgin. He will do well. That is okay for a parent to say, "No, honey, I love you, but I've just read the preceding 35 verses of this letter. And I'm saying to you, honey, you're headed for nothing but trouble. An inspired apostle says so. Look at it, read it." Now, I'm saying to you, honey, no. In a culture which arranged marriages, in a culture where the parents had far more authority over their children than they do now, Paul says to those parents, you, if you can, but I think the first 9 verses still apply, you can say no, and you'd be real smart if you do. But, 38, he then adds, so then, both he who gives his own daughter in marriage, betrothed don't give anybody in marriage. This is why I think it's the daughter and not the betrothed husband who's in this position. I don't think he had this much authority to begin with. And after everything Paul said, because of fornication, let them marry, for a betrothed guy to now say, I'm not going to have sex with you because I'm not going to marry you, I'm just going to keep you under betrothal, I just think, you know, isn't possible here. I'm believing she'd back out of such a betrothal to begin with. So in 38, both he who gives his own virgin daughter, it's my view, in marriage does well. He who does not give her in marriage will do better. This passage, this chapter is about best. Not so good. Not so good at all. It's about good, better, and best. It's not about demanding this, that, or another thing. It's not forbidding this, that, or another thing. He's saying, here are all the possible circumstances. Now you choose among these options what is best, what is good, or what is, you know, not so good. So, I guess I didn't finish it all. 39 and 40. A wife is bound as long as her husband lives. But if her husband is dead, she's free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. I do believe that says no Christian should ever even think about marrying an unbeliever. That's my conviction. Only in the Lord. I've seen a number of ways people try, you know, to get around that, but I can't imagine what else it would be. He's saying you can get married, but in the Lord, what else could it mean? And then 40. But in my opinion, she's happier if she remains as she is. And I think I also have the Spirit of God. Now, is that his uninspired opinion? He thinks he has the Spirit of God. You may accept that or reject it as you like. It's just Paul's opinion. No, he has the Spirit of God, doesn't he? Sure he does. He's proved it. Miracles and all the rest. So, which you may not be able to read this, is parents, keep your daughter unmarried. Make her burn. No. No, brethren, verses 1 through 9 still apply. And he says so, I think, pretty plainly. He who stands firm in his heart, being under no constraint. The chief of all those constraints would be this woman's inability because she doesn't have Paul's gift. So, you can give her or not. But if you can keep her from it, including the first 9 verses' urges, then keep her. Now, let me close like this, and it might go just a second or more over. Here's the summary of what? 15 weeks. So 15 weeks. Oh, look, he actually moved forward in his chair. This is his first class, and now he gets to 15 weeks. All right. Number one, my view is in no danger whatsoever of being guilty of the doctrine of demons. I do not forbid marriage. I will not do it. Ever. I don't forbid marriage. That is a doctrine of demons. I used to believe there were certain exemptions where you must teach the doctrine of demons and enforce it. Up to and including not baptizing somebody unless they agree to get rid of a current mate and remain celibate for the rest of their lives. I used to teach that. I don't anymore. And so I am no longer even wondering if I would be guilty of that. You know, for sure, with my view, you can't be charged with that. Number two, my view recognizes God's eternal sovereignty. It does not make God subject to man's evil. Now, a lot of people, and I used to think, Matthew 19 said that God didn't want to give Moses, you know, this new law and lower the standard and let all the Jews divorce their wives for whatever cause at all. I used to think that's what that verse meant. I don't anymore. I don't believe God will ever yield to sin. He is never going to say, if your heart's hard toward me, then I'll change my law for you. That never happens, to my knowledge, in all the scriptures. So, much of my old position was built on that false idea that I was erroneously deriving from Matthew 19. My view also recognizes God's eternal nature. God has always hated divorce. He still hates divorce. But God has always loved women and protected them. So I do not believe that for 1,500 years, Moses was allowed, or maybe took it upon himself, depending on who you talk to with that view. I do not believe that Moses said, okay, these evil men don't want to serve God anymore, so you wives, get ready for your divorce, because now they can divorce you for any reason at all. Doesn't take just adultery anymore. Now you can divorce them for any cause you want. 1,500 years, Jews only, Gentiles not subject to that. Brethren, I don't think that's even in God's nature to do such a thing as that. And my view recognizes the right to marry, that it is better to marry than to burn, universally. I do not sometimes say that's true, and other times it's still true, but too bad, you're forbidden to marry. I just don't do that anymore. It also recognizes the right to remain in the condition in which we are called. I used to teach that about 50% of the American population was going to have to give up their current mate in order to become a Christian. The only way they could demonstrate repentance was to divorce somebody because they should have been married, you know, got a wrong mate. No, I believe the passage we just read says you should remain in the condition in which you are called by the gospel into Christianity. Whatever marital condition you're in, you stay in it. Remain in the condition in which you're called. My view also, and this is very important to me, because for very, 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 very many years, I listened to all the debates, I read the books, I met people all the time saying, Larry, your view doesn't respect marriage at all. Your view just lets anybody divorce who wants to. Your view just casts off all marital rights. You're going to have divorces everywhere and people marrying whoever they want. But I now have 40 years of experience, because I never saw that happen when I held the old view, and I've never seen it happen now that I've held the new one either. 20-some years I've held the new one. My view results in fewer divorces, not more. The other view requires legions of people to get divorces and creates a great deal more of what God hates. I know why I used to think that was a good thing, but I see my error now. So my view now results in fewer divorces. That is a historical, observable, and verifiable fact. It didn't kick the bungs out and create a bunch of divorce. That just never happened. And it recognizes God's consistency. I believe we have had the same marital law since Adam and Eve. It never changed. All people, all time. Doesn't matter if you're a Jew or a Gentile. Doesn't matter if you're a Christian or an atheist. Doesn't matter if you lived before Abraham or a Jew under Abraham. Doesn't matter if you lived under the law. Doesn't matter if now you're a Christian. God has always taught this. Don't get married if you can avoid it. That's the best condition you can be in. It'll secure undistracted devotion. You'll be free from concern. But most people can't. So it's better to marry than to burn. In order to avoid fornication, get married. When you get married, stay married. Period. But some people get divorces before they become Christians, and some people get divorces because their mate committed adultery. A lot of these things happen. When that happens, stay unmarried. Or else be reconciled. Unless you're burning and can't be reconciled. That's my view. And that's always been God's view from Adam and Eve to today. That preserves the sanctity of marriage, allows appropriate separations, and very limited fornication, but accepts the fact that people don't always obey God's will, so it tells them what to do after they've made the mistake. Thank you for the extra 4 minutes.